All right, tomorrow's the big day, so it's really convenient that my Wednesday political panel happens the day before. Joining us now to talk politics in the House, Sally Hauser, Senior Consultant at Navigator Limited. Hey, Sally.
Hey, Tasha.
You've been active in this election a little bit here?
I have indeed. It's been a wild ride this far, you know?
I bet it has. Well, I know it has. On the phones with us now, Leif Malin, conservative strategist. Hi, Leif.
Good afternoon.
Good. Are you feeling tired?
I'm feeling tired. I'm feeling hopeful, and it's an exciting day.
Well, it'll be an exciting day tomorrow, that is for sure. Bob Richardson rounds out our trio today, senior counsel at National Public Relations. How's your mood today, Bob?
Well, less exciting than I think the other two, but still pretty good.
Now all the listeners absolutely know where everybody stands on the political spectrum, too. So let's get into it. The latest poll, because we love polls, done by Ipsos. It's the last one we're doing here at Global News before the vote tomorrow. Shows that if the election were today, the PCs would get a majority based on seat distribution, chiefly the 905. 39% of decided voters say they'll vote PC, 36% NDP, and 19% Liberal. Sally, I will start with you. Does this jive with what you think is going to happen tomorrow?
Well, it'll be interesting. And, I can see where people talk a lot about the Conservatives' vote distribution and that efficiency. Really what the NDP is going to need is for that Liberal vote to collapse even more than it already has to the NDP, to have that kind of rally of an anti-Ford vote, of a more progressive Ontario vote come out, even in people, if they voted Liberal in the past, been staunch Liberals, even Conservatives out there that, you know, would typically vote Conservative but want change and frankly find Doug Ford not palatable, too reckless. I think you can see some really big surprises tomorrow. But, you know, that being said, I think it's going to be a really tight one. I think it's going to be a real nail biter. And the fact that the Conservatives have kind of managed to blow this massive lead they had just kind of two short months ago with the campaign the NDP has run, I think everybody should be very proud of it.
All right, Leif, how did the PCs blow that lead? 39%, if that's what they end up getting, still it's majority territory, but they certainly were polling above 40%, when Doug Ford took the leadership. People thought it would be an absolute cakewalk for them.
Yeah, I think the NDP's run a spirited campaign, and clearly Andrew, a lot of people have responded positively to Andrew Horvath, and we've seen a lot of people who are traditional Liberal voters tomorrow we're going to vote for Andrea Horvath. So a credit to her and a credit to Sally's team for running a good campaign. I think the suggestion that the PC vote has collapsed because it was slightly over 40 and now is perhaps at 39 seems to be overstated. We'll see what the final numbers are tomorrow. It seems pretty clear that most Ontarians want change and that most Ontarians who want change want Doug Ford to be the next premier and are endorsing the PC vision of lower taxes and lower hydro rates. And, you know, I think that's the endorsement we're going to see tomorrow.
All right. Bob, your leader conceded over the weekend, something you've never seen in memory from any political party before, basically saying, I'm not going to be premier, so please vote Liberal. Which makes no sense to me. What was the method to her madness there? And do you think that's going to pay any dividends tomorrow?
Well, that would make two of us. I wouldn't do that. I don't think it made sense. I think you fight right to the end. I think her intention was honorable. It was, hey, look, I know I'm holding the party back. Let's move me aside and you can vote for local MPPs. But I think that's a subtle nuance that's lost on a lot of folks. I don't think it's been helpful. We'll wait and see what happens tomorrow. But, you know, by any standard, this has been a horrific campaign. When you go from 55 seats or whatever it is, you know, struggling to get 5 to 10, that's not good. And part of the reason is the decision was made 12 months ago when she decided to stay. Had she left, I think the Ontario Liberal Party would have had a opportunity to fight another day, maybe take 30 seats, maybe 30-something percent of the vote and live to fight another day. But her negatives were just too high at minus 50. We knew it 12 months ago. The decision should have been made then. It wasn't, and we are where we are today.
That's interesting. You know, I remember a year ago having these conversations, should she stay or should she go, with listeners. Most of our listeners said she should go. I don't think they were people who were going to vote liberal necessarily. They just were frustrated with her. The fact she didn't go, though, and the PCs did switch, Leaf, you know, it's kind of ironic because some people say, well, you know, Patrick Brown, Kathleen Wynne campaign, how different do you think that would have been? Would it have been as polarizing necessarily as the one we've seen with Doug Ford?
It's really tough to say. It's really tough to imagine how a Patrick Brown versus Kathleen Wynne campaign would have gone. I mean, obviously, you know, some of the things that have come out since about machinations and political machinations associated with Patrick Brown's tenure, you know, likely those kinds of things would have come out in the campaign and changed the campaign. So I think you know, progressive conservatives are pleased that that we were able to have a smooth transition a couple of months ago, have a new leader. I think this was the campaign Ontarians deserved. It was a stark contrast between three different visions, and, you know, perhaps a different kind of campaign might have been smoother, quote unquote. But this was probably a fair campaign. You know, do you want larger government, higher taxes? Do you want a different kind of change with smaller government, another party defending its record for the last 15 years? You know, this was a real exercise and a real choice for voters.
It has become a really polarized choice, actually, Sally. And some would say that's a good thing, in the sense that you do have this sort of big picture debate of the size of government, the type of government you want. You know, looking back in hindsight, did you envision the race developing this way? I mean, how do we get to the point where we are talking about those big picture issues, which so often get lost in a campaign?
I did envision it going that way, to be honest. I thought, and I certainly hoped, that it would come down to Andrea Horvath versus Doug Ford, as it has in the end. You know, what I didn't anticipate, if we're having those big vision, you know, conversations, that one side of that conversation wouldn't have a costed platform. You know, that
yeah,
was something
bit,
that kind of surprised
me. We're still waiting
me.
For that one.
Yeah. You know, but it's been a good battle. I fought right till the bitter end. In terms of the contrast between the campaign, obviously they've tried to keep Doug Ford a bit under wraps, been very, very tight on the media availabilities, very, very kind of muted in terms of his availabilities, always standing up in front in that kind of dour blue background. And then, you know, we're watching it on the TV right now. In fact, Andrea Horvath always pictured surrounded by people, supporters, volunteers, out mainstreeting, you know, taking that risk of kind of being around the public an awful lot. And I think that kind of shows a lot of momentum.
Well, is it also because she had less to lose? Doug Ford came in as the front runner, so you're going to run a more cautious campaign. She, however, had, you know, she had to run flat out to try and capture the crown. And, you know, she we still don't know. It's the votes tomorrow. You never know if she might. I want to take it back, though, Bob, to Kathleen Wynne for a moment and the Liberals, because, you know, again, Kathleen Wynne was supposed to be the anti-Ford. It was supposed to be a Ford-Wynne debate or Ford-Wynne campaign. It did not go that way. Once the election's over, she's conceded she's not going to be there. What is the future you see for the Liberal Party in terms of rebuilding, rebranding? Where should it go from here?
Well, let's see how many seats we get, whether we have official party status or not. I think it's very safe to say that the Kathleen Wynne era is over. If we have official party status, then, you know, I think we'll live to fight another day. If we don't, then I think we need to have an adult conversation whether the party continues or whether there's a new entity that gets created in Ontario. So, you know, I think there'll be a number of those discussions to come. But I do want to say one thing. I don't think Ontarians are happy with the choices that they've had. They had one leader that they clearly didn't want, and they said so 12 months ago, and the party didn't listen. They have a party who seems to recruit its candidates from the bar scene from Star Wars every 4 years, the NDP. And then they have a leader in the Conservatives who's probably the least qualified person to be premier of this province in 30 years as a major candidate for any of the three parties. So I think it's a bit of a pox on all three of your houses.
You sound like the Globe and Mail.
And I don't think that's good. Well, you know what? I've been saying this long before the Globe and Mail, but I'm glad they agree with me.
Well, you mentioned the candidate issues. I want to ask you how much that resonates. Not that it shouldn't be important, but In this election, you know, Sally, there's been also, there's been the weird zone of the NDP, the downright offensive zone. On the PC side, there's also been candidates who've said things, done things. In fact, some have been dumped, like Tanya Granick-Allen. How much does that resonate with the average voter?
You know, I think there's usually 1 week during the campaign where that, you know, campaigns call it dropping a bomb or something like that.
There have been a lot of bombs dropped. This has been like the napalm election, frankly.
But you see that typically right around the middle of the campaign. And I think some of them stick and some of them don't. I do think personally that there is a difference between something stupid that was posted on your Facebook, 15 years ago and during the campaign getting into a physical altercation with a child, as
you're
we saw with
Raymond Cho of Scarborough, who is accused of tapping a kid on the head at Raymond Cho's 81. I was surprised by that. I mean, good on him for that, but not good to hit a kid over the head. No.
You know, and then there's another candidate in Brampton North that has four separate fraud lawsuits against him. You had the 407 data breach that can include as much as 29 of the conservative candidates. And then you got Doug Ford himself, who's the subject of a lawsuit right now.
Well, I was going to get to that, Leif. The amount of mud that's been thrown at Doug Ford personally, and not just by the parties, this lawsuit too has come out now, and the other parties have seized on it. Even Andrea Horvath, the NDP, Merritt Stiles, one of the candidates, came out today and attacked Doug Ford on that basis. That piece, did the PCs, was that one of the issues with Ford's candidacy from the beginning, was the fear that he would be such a lightning rod that a lot of the vitriol would be directed at him on a very personal basis? How has that played out?
I think, you know, to tie it back to your earlier comment about a cast of characters and, you know, the wacky NDP candidates versus the other choices that are on offer, I think the way it's played out is that people have seen the roster of candidates that Doug Ford has assembled, and they see a cabinet in waiting, a government in waiting. So people aren't just looking at the PC party. They aren't just looking at Doug Ford. They're looking at Christine Elliott and Carolyn Mulroney and Rod Phillips and Vic Fedeli, some of the strong performers in the PC caucus, and seeing that next government. And, you know, it's fine for Sally to talk about her leader around ordinary people. The reason Andrea Horvath has to appear with ordinary people is because she can't appear with her candidates.
Ooh.
Because there is no cabinet in waiting there.
Them's fighting words. All right. We'll fight on another day about this, but right now we got to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to switch to the federal scene because Justin Trudeau is set to host the G7. What kind of message should he send to Donald Trump? We'll be back with that in a moment on Global News Radio 640 Toronto. All right. Welcome back to our panel. Leif Malling, conservative strategist, Sally Hauser, senior consultant at Navigator Limited, and Bob Richardson, senior counsel at National Public Relations. Okay, there is still some federal politics happening, despite everything that's going on here in Ontario. Our prime minister is also busy with his agenda. And this was supposed to be his big moment to host the G7 summit in Quebec. All the G7 leaders are coming. Donald Trump's casting a big shadow over that, of course, because of the tariffs that were imposed over the weekend and the response from Canada and the other countries. So, you know what? I will start with you, Bob. Trudeau says that this is going to be, of course, they'll be on the agenda. He also, though, wants to push all sorts of things like gender equality. He says that's going to be the top priority of the G7 summit. Really? Really? You know, should he just focus on the ball here, which is the economic one, and maybe leave that stuff to the side?
Look, I think he is focusing on the economic agenda. I think that will be the number one. I think it'll be the number one issue in bilaterals. And in terms of the lead up to it, that's certainly been the case. I think trade will end up dominating that. I think gender equality has been on the table. There are a number of countries who do want to have discussions about it and see if there are things that can be moved forward. I believe both Germany and France are examples of those. So I think it's a bit much to say he's only focused on gender equality. He's not saying that. And I think we'll find that at the end of the day, the focus of this, positive or negative, and with Trump it could go either way, will be on trade, will be on tariffs, and will be on economic development.
Okay, so Sally, how should he approach those issues? I mean, how do you, if you were standing there with Trump for the group photo, would you have a smile on your face? How should Trudeau act towards him? as a host?
You know, I would imagine that, you know, at least outwardly for those photo ops, that you know, they'll be nothing but gracious. But, I mean, to be a fly on the wall for some of these conversations with, you know, l'enfant terrible from south of the border there will be fascinating. You know, Donald Trump is not somebody who responds to kind of outside pressure. He does not care about how he's viewed by other world leaders. He cares very deeply about how some people view him, but that does not kind of pressure from his, you know, his peers in the G7 doesn't seem to work. I think he's going to come in and continue to drop big old stink bombs for certainly the Canadian government, but other governments, you know, our allies and other governments across the world. How you deal with it, I think certainly for these kind of big international conferences, Trudeau tends to do fairly well at them, unlike kind of the India trip or things like that.
There are no outfits here, I don't think so.
Yeah. But, you know, trying to kind of get himself in front of the media as much as possible with that positive message of the government is all you can do, really.
Okay, well, he's not the only one getting his message out. Apparently, Donald Trump is going to be using the stage, according to his top economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, to extol the virtues of tax cuts and red tape rollbacks that the U.S. administration says are responsible for the growth in the states. And it's true. They've got low unemployment, high growth, Leaf. Unfortunately, though, with all the animosity against Trump, do you think it could backfire that other countries will not listen to him on those points because they're so mad that he's imposed these tariffs? Leaf?
Great.
Hi, Leif. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I just asked you what you think about Donald Trump's idea of extolling tax cuts at this event. He's going to be pushing the message, the pro-growth message of the United States, but I'm wondering if it's going to get lost because everyone is so angry about him, about the tariffs he's imposed on their countries.
Tasha, so many of us who are on the center right of the political spectrum, like myself, are terrified that the association with Trump will hurt that message, will hurt the message of smaller government, lower taxes, pro-growth. That I mean, certainly tariffs is not part of our agenda, but absolutely the world over, the standard conservative message, standard center-right message is being diminished by Trump, and the association with his brand is not helpful. At the conference itself, I mean, I'm baffled by why the prime minister would be pursuing anything other than an economic message. And, you know, at a time when Canada is being threatened with these tariffs, at a time when we can't get oil to market and the government's intervening, you know, far be it for me to advise the current prime minister, but I would be all over this with a Captain Canada economic message.
Okay, well,
Trump will provide a contrast.
We'll see what they do to end up discussing at this thing. A little closer to home, anyway, I want to end this conversation with a debt situation, not our country's debt situation, thankfully, this time, but the candidates for the PC, or the conservative, rather, federal leadership. Kevin O'Leary has sounded this bell. He is actually saying he wants to sue or file a lawsuit against Elections Canada, saying that it's not fair that he can't pay back his campaign debt himself. He has about $529,000. His debt is now down to $390,000. He says he's paid off the balance of that. But $390,000 he owes. Other candidates also owe a lot of money. I was kind of surprised to realize this. Lisa Raitt owes $11,000, not too much. Kelly Leach, $103,000. Maxime Bernier, $92,000. Aaron O'Toole, $75,000. This is not chump change, and they're prevented by the law from paying it back themselves because candidates can only donate $25,000 to their own campaign. Sally, is it unfair? Should they change the rules so it says that, you know, after the campaign's over, if you lost, you could pay it back yourself?
Well, you know, you pays your money and you takes your chances,
I suppose,
right? You know, those regulations are in place for a reason. It's so that, you know, the very wealthy in a given country can't just come in and say, well, I'm going to spend $2 million of my own money and finance the most expensive, craziest campaign we ever have. So those regulations are in place for an absolute reason. I don't know, maybe Kevin O'Leary can gin up some kind of reality TV show like Pay My Bills or something like that.
A sort of crowdfunding thing. He is doing that, but it's not working that well.
No, absolutely not. I'd say keep the law as it is.
Okay. All right. Bob, what do you think? Should this law be changed to allow people to pay back their debts? I mean, he's not going to be leader now. Who cares if he pays it back himself?
Well, you know, number one, Kevin O'Leary might be able to chip away at his debt, but that would require him to spend 15 minutes in the country, something he hasn't done for a leadership race. So he has put the B back in buffoon and is very difficult to take seriously.
But he's not the only one here, though. If you don't have sympathy for him, what about some of the other? Even the NDP, Guy Caron, owes $58,000, apparently. They can go to jail if they don't pay it back within 3 years.
I'm not so sure that we shouldn't take another look at these rules. I think they're probably, by and large, right. They could use some fine-tuning, but I think they're too restrictive. And I think it's making it more difficult for people to get in when I think one of the reasons they were put in place is to make it less difficult for some candidates to get in. So I'm not sure we've hit the sweet spot yet. I'm not sure Kevin O'Leary should be the front man for this. I think it should be somebody more credible. But I think a review of these rules probably makes some sense and some adjustments are needed.
Okay, last to you, Leif. Do you think there should be adjustments? All the conservative candidates do owe some. Tony Clement only owes $316. So he's doing pretty well there. Someone could cut him a check, it would be done. But the rest of them, it's not nothing. Should the law be changed?
It should absolutely be changed. Blow it up. We need to start from scratch. The whole movement we've had in the last 25 years to take money out of politics has gone way too far. Now parties and political candidates don't have the resources they need. You know, I'll end it on this note. I think, unfortunately, tomorrow in Ontario, we might see a very low voter turnout. And if we see a low voter turnout, it'll be in part because parties don't have the resources they need to encourage people to vote and get people out to the polls. And, you know, we need to give this a rethink because we're starving our democracy on a principle of not having money in politics. And it's not good for the democratic process.
Okay, well, we'll see how many people show up tomorrow. I have a funny feeling it's going to be high. Based on the advance polls, I have a funny feeling it's a change election. They're usually higher than usual, but we will see. I want to thank all three of you, Leif Malling, Sally Hauser, and Bob Richardson. Thanks so much for being our political panel today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.